The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight, what I would like to talk about is developing wisdom. You know, the practice that we do is insight meditation, and the question is, how does insight arise, and what does it mean? How would you know when you found it? And so, because I feel very humble about this particular topic, I'm going to introduce it with a poem that expresses really how I feel about it. The name of the poem is Directions. It's by David Budbill, from a book called While We've Still Got Feet, which has to do with the last poem that says, let's dance while we still have feet. But this one is called Directions. I should also tell you that he's a poet that lives in a place in Vermont called Jude Vine Mountain, a recluse. Sometimes people ask me how to get to Jude Vine Mountain. I can tell you how to get to where the road ends, but when you get to there, you've only just begun. After that, I can't be any help at all. It takes years to find the way, and anyhow, you don't need me. I'm lost most of the time myself. Besides, how would I know what direction you're headed in? Sometimes people ask me how to get to Jude Vine Mountain. I can tell you how to get to where the road ends, but when you get to there, you've only just begun. After that, I can't be any help at all. It takes years to find the way. And anyhow, you don't need me. I'm lost most of the time myself. Besides, how would I know what direction you're headed in? So this poem is really a clue to how I view the whole area of developing insight, developing wisdom. There are several elements to it. So there's the statement, I know, I've been there, right? He's in Jude Vine Mountain. And there's an aspect of wisdom that has to do with, I know because I've been there. I've seen this happen. I've had this experience. There's also the idea that practice has led me there. Through repetition, I know kind of where I am. I've kind of found this place. I'm feeling kind of comfortable there. I can see the patterns of my life, my responses. I can see how my mind works. As we meditate, the longer we meditate, the more we see about how the mind is working and what it does when we're not paying attention. Also in the poem is the idea that you can point to the path. You can point the way. You can say, you know, if you look here, you might find something. But it isn't the path. It's only pointing the path. You know, if you start this way, there's a chance that you're going to see something as you walk this way. But it's only pointing to the path. And then there's the idea of the concept versus the experience. I have an idea, the path. I'm meditating. Meditation is going to do this. I have an idea about what meditation is going to do and how it's going to influence my life. It's not the same thing as what actually happens, nor is it the same thing as actually meditating. It's like sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and I'll think, well, maybe I'll just meditate here in bed. Well, that's usually a prescription for not meditating, right? It's sort of what I'm doing instead. It's like exercising in my mind. I think I'm going to run around the block, and you go through every step of running around the block, but unless you actually run around the block, nothing happens. It's a little like that. And then there's the point of guidance. You know, we use teachers, friends, reading. There's a guidance for how to get to where you want to go. And that only goes so far. There's also the intention. Unless you know where you want to go, it doesn't matter how fast you're going. Now you have to kind of have an idea of where you want to point with this path. So there was a book written by a Zen master by the name of Soko Morinaga. And he was a monk in Kyoto. And the name of the book was called Novice to Master, An Ongoing Lesson in the Extent of My Own Stupidity. I thought that was kind of an interesting title. So he says, if I were to sum up the last 40 years of my life, the time since I became a monk, I would have to say that it's been an ongoing lesson in the extent of my own stupidity. When I speak of stupidity, I do not refer to something that is innate, but rather to the false impressions that I have cleverly stockpiled layer upon layer in my imagination. Crush the false notions of one's own imagination. When it comes to seeing reality, no medicine can cure folly. Anything that causes one to see the foolishness of our actions and the delusions, that is a true medicine. Now, I thought that was kind of interesting for somebody who's been a monk for 40 years. Early in my practice as a meditator, I remember going on a retreat, and it was a retreat that was led by Joseph Goldstein, who some of you probably know of, a very famous Western teacher. And I went to him and said, you know, I'm a little discouraged because I'm never going to be a nun. That's just not in my life. I'm not going to do that. That's not my inclination. So is meditating really going to get me anywhere? You know, this whole thing is kind of a giant experiment. If I'm not going to be a monastic, does that mean that I'm really never going to be free of suffering? That I'm just kind of fooling myself? And he said, well, you're right. It's an experiment. Why don't you do it? And I thought, well, that was kind of flippant. But it was actually true. You know, it was a very wise thing to say. That we don't really know the outcome of anything we do, despite all of our attempts to control things and to make them come out a certain way, or to decide what's good and what's bad. Things happen as we go along. So I'm somewhat interested in this idea of Buddhism that sort of implies that freedom lies in inner spiritual development. Now, while I think that there's some truth to that, it basically says that unless we're sitting on the cushion in a cross-legged position going, and somehow achieving some sort of inner calm, that there's no hope for life to be free of suffering. And I just am not willing to accept that. And I'm trying to decide, at what point do I realize that that inner work that I'm doing has a lot to do with the external work of living in the world? That if it doesn't translate to the life I'm living, it's of limited value. And that's the place where I'm looking for wisdom. That the insights that come to me on the cushion have to have some place in the life that I'm living out in the world, because I'm not living my life in a monastery. It's got to have some real meaning for me. And that meaning arises out of whether I am free of the habits of my mind every day as I encounter anything that I encounter. So it's this place of how do I recognize the insights that come to me in my real life that have meaning for me. So that's kind of what I want to talk about. Sometimes we have the idea, let's say that I want to translate this inner peace that I'm achieving on the cushion, sometimes that actually happens, into my everyday life. Then the assumption is that I should always be an equanimous, calm person, unflappable. Nobody's going to knock me off balance. I'm going to be always compassionate. I'm going to live according to the precepts. I'm going to be honest and caring and straightforward, and probably an impossible human. Somehow I have to be able to live this life that involves being human. And so creating this idea of the ideal person and trying to match myself against that ideal person is probably not going to work, because I am human, as are we all. So whatever it is has to be something that takes that into account. It has to be useful. So for me, wisdom is not about some absolute knowledge or some attainment, some great insight attainment that is an ideal conception. It really has to do with something that's useful. Wisdom is something you can use. It isn't knowledge. It's something that you can use in your life. So one of the things I want to avoid is somehow creating a spiritual life that implies that I'm a monk in lay clothing. You know, this is just not going to work, because that's not how I'm living my life. But there is something in this life that lessens the suffering in my life, that makes my life more joyful, that allows me to really live this life, inhabit this life. And for me, that means not letting the form take the place of the practice. And by that I mean sitting on the cushion is a practice that I have, the meditation that I use, that helps me to see what's going on with me. It helps me to be embodied. It helps me to see what the mind patterns are that I have developed, these habits of mind that reflect my responses to what I encounter in the world. But sitting on the cushion isn't my practice in the world. Whatever I attain sitting on the cushion, whatever insights I might have, things that I notice, really are put into practice in everything that I do. So let's take an example. Recently, I did a month-long retreat. And in case you think I'm opposed to meditating, that's not the case. On this retreat, one of the things that happened is I became very still. And the advantage of becoming very still is that things start moving a little more slowly, and you can actually see what your mind is doing. This is the real advantage. It's slowed down enough that you can catch on to it. And one of the things I realized, and I forget how it came up, these things come up in odd ways, but I realized that I had a closet full of clothes that were in the closet because they reminded me of a person I used to be. So I have a bunch of suits and blouses and clothes that are a part of a corporate America. Now, I haven't worn most of these clothes for 7 or 8 years, and they're still in my closet. And I was asking myself, why are those things still in my closet? And I realized that it was like having a mannequin sitting over here that represented Maria, the corporate woman. The interesting thing is, I was probably never that woman. Not only was I holding on to something that was an image, but I probably was never that image. I was holding on to something I wasn't, even. I immediately wanted to leave the retreat, go home, and sell all those clothes, which wouldn't have been very useful. But it was pretty interesting to me to finally come to the realization that all of the excuses I had for not cleaning out my closet really only had to do with my attachment to an image that I didn't even care about anymore. But it was a construct that I had, that I was carrying around with me, that somehow defined something about me. Because there was a lot of comfort in that image. You know, I was a very competent person. I could list these things that went along with that image that I valued. The only thing is, I would never do that again because, in truth, I don't value it. But I was in the habit of valuing it. And I just didn't notice it. So one of the things that I realized while I was on the subject of that image was that I had another image of the person that I did want to be. Okay, so there's the old image of the person I was, and then there was the image of the person I wanted to be over here. And I realized it had no more corporality than the other image, you know? It didn't have anything to do with anything. It was just an image. Okay, so this was a nice insight that I had while I was on retreat. I come away from a retreat. Now I'm faced with, you know, this person going through her everyday life, and all of a sudden I don't have any of these images that I had been carefully nurturing that could tell me who I was. That was actually a little scary. Now I'm walking around in my life just having to be whatever I was. Well, now that's an interesting idea. And I realized that's what I really want, is to go through my life being whoever I am at the moment that I am that. End of story. And how much space there was in that. So in thinking about wisdom, I said, how do we know wisdom? How do we develop wisdom? Where does it come from? And there are kind of four things that happen. So there's the learning that happens, and the learning can happen through experience, through teachings, through reading. You learn something. And then there is the reflection. You think about it. You see how it applies. You look at what's true about it. You see whether it has any, whether you've seen it before. So you consider it. And then you practice. Okay, now that I know this, what do I do with it? And the fourth one is repeat. Learn, reflect, practice, repeat. Because we're never there. It's not as if something happens and we've learned the story and now we're there. It's always changing. It's always evolving. It's never permanent. You know what? This is a good thing. I don't know about you, but I have this habit of saying, as soon as I get all this stuff done, then I can slow down and everything's going to be fine and I'm going to do all these things I've wanted to do. Well, I'll tell you a secret. The only way to slow down is to slow down. It isn't to wait for something else to happen. If you want to do something, if it has a meaning for you, this is where it has meaning, right now, here, do it. This is it. Now, I know that sounds simplistic. We all have responsibilities and commitments, and all of that is true. But we have a tendency to kind of live into the future or live into the past. And the idea of just being right here is a lot harder. But in fact, it's the simple thing. It's actually the simple thing. So, the trick is not to worry so much about what is absolutely true, but what is useful. What is useful? How can I live my life right now in a way that's useful? There are lots of ways to learn things, experience being one of my favorites. And reading, I like reading. I like listening to talks. When we get this information, however, applying it to us requires us to somehow integrate it. And that's the reflective part. So I was thinking about what reflection is, because it isn't just letting the mind kind of wander off. You know, you start the topic and then let it run. Reflection actually has a big component that has to do with awareness. So you've probably all walked by a wall of mirrors. The mirrors are up there, and they do a number of things, one of which is reflect images from opposite them. And you know that the mirror is there, and you walk by it, and it's reflecting you. But if you don't look at it, you don't know the reflection. You don't recognize the reflection. It's reflecting, but you have to be aware of it before it gives you any information. This is, the reflection is similar to that, the reflection that I'm talking about, which has to do with knowing that you know something is happening. The other thing about a reflection is you can kind of get the general thing. So you have the colors, or you see movement. But if you want to see details, you have to really look at it. And this is true in our lives also. We have to really look at what's happening. You have to see it. So today, I got up about 8 o'clock. I slept in. We were out late last night. And I've had a lot of late nights, and I knew I was going to be late tonight. I live up in West Marin, so I have a long drive home. So I slept in, 8 o'clock. I get up at 8 o'clock. I have my plan, you know. I've got a couple of hours. I do hospice on Thursday afternoons in San Francisco, so I had my plan. I get up, my husband has a different plan. He's decided that the market is crashing this morning, we have to talk about our finances. I cannot tell you how far I was from being ready to talk about finances the moment I woke up this morning. It's not fun for me to begin with, but when I first wake up, not good, not good. And so here he is. He's been up for a few hours considering, and he's ready to go, and I am not ready. And so I explained to him I had to have my cup of coffee first, and then I could consider what he wanted to talk about. But what I noticed is that I never really caught up with my body after that. I went through the process. I had the coffee. We had our conversation. I explained to him I had this talk to prepare for tonight. I had to take my shower. I had to get ready to go. I'm getting ready. I get ready. I go off. I get to hospice, and I realize I'm there, but my mind is still back there somewhere. My body has left. It's going on, doing all the things that I set in motion to happen today, but I wasn't embodied. I wasn't there present with my body. My mind just had plain not caught up with me. Now, I say that because I know what it feels like to be embodied. I know when I'm in my body, I can feel it. You know? You can put your hands on your knees just for a moment. You got your hands down there. Now, you're all pretty much aware of your hands on your knees right now because I've just called your attention to it. But if I tell you to think about your nose and whether it's itching and you've got your focus on your nose, you kind of lose track of those hands. And the same thing is true when you're busy running through the day. You lose track of being aware of the fact that you're embodied and right here in this, present for what's actually happening. So you're running through doing all the things that you've set in motion, but you're not present for them. That's how I felt today. I wasn't there. Now, fortunately, at the beginning of the hospice session, the first thing we do is sit and meditate, and that allowed me to kind of pull myself back into my body, you know, and pay attention to the feel of my hands on my legs and follow my breath, and just get back in my body. So what happened? Because I have developed the practice on the cushion of noticing what it feels like to be in my body, today, midday, admittedly late, I was able to realize I wasn't in my body. I just wasn't there for it. I wasn't present for the experiences I was having. Well, if you're not ready, if you're not present for them, anything can happen. You know? I was off doing my thing, but I wasn't really participating in it. So one thing that reflection does is it kind of expands the space. You know how it makes the room bigger? A mirror will make the room bigger. Reflection kind of does that too. It gives you a chance to actually see things because you've stopped and said, what's here? Okay, so it kind of expands the space. It gives you the opportunity to notice whether you're just looking at the colors of your life or you're looking at the details of your life. You know, am I really paying attention to this? So in the exchange I was having with my husband this morning, after we got through with our financial conversation, I went down and started getting things ready, and I realized that there was this anxiety in my body. And I thought, oh, this is all his fault. He's always doing this. He always wants it. It has to be on his schedule. And I had this thing going until I realized that the anxiety wasn't just that he wanted to talk about finances. It was that I had planned something else, and I wasn't getting to do that. And so noticing the anxiety was only part of it. Reflecting on that anxiety allowed me to see where I was going astray. Where I was creating meaning out of something which was convenient, oh, my husband is always this way, which was a way of not having to pay any attention to what I was doing. I labeled it, I put it in a box, I had an excuse, I didn't have to think about it. Well, the bad news was, as long as I maintained that construct about it being his fault that I was anxious, I wasn't able to deal with my anxiety because I wasn't taking ownership of it. It was his anxiety. He caused it. It's over there in that box. So that's something that we do. We make these constructs around what we experience, and then we don't actually see them. We don't actually see what's going on because we have a clue. You know, it's like you hear the first three bars of a song and you say, oh, I know what that is. We do that with all of our experiences. We say, oh, I know what that is. That's so-and-so doing such-and-such. He always does that. We only had three notes. It could be an entirely different song. So part of wisdom is not assuming on a very small amount of information that we know what's true. It's leaving the possibility open that we don't know it yet and having that be okay. Having it be okay that I don't know what this is. To understand that the real joy of engaging with life is to not necessarily know what's going on, to not know the answer. Because very often, when we put something in a box, it's a familiar box that we've put a big ribbon around, which is usually not a brightly colored ribbon. It's more like a dirty rubber band. We say, oh yeah, that always happens, because we remember something that caused us unhappiness or pain or dissatisfaction. I'm going to read this little poem by Mary Oliver. It's called, I Don't Want to Live a Small Life. I don't want to live a small life. Open your eyes. Open your hands. I've just come from the berry fields, the sun kissing me with its golden mouth all the way. Open your hands. And the wind-winged clouds following along, thinking perhaps I might feed them. But no, I carry these heart shapes only to you. Look how many, how small, but so sweet, and maybe the last gift I will ever bring to anyone in this world of risk and hope. So do. Look at me. Open your life. Open your hands. I like this poem because it's about right now, right in this minute. Doesn't have big meaning. But isn't it delightful? Returning from the berry fields, I bring you this gift because I can, and who knows, it could be the last time I can. But we might otherwise construct some other story around that. We might say, oh, I better bring this to you because it may be the last time I can ever bring you anything. Instead of thinking of the warm sun and the bright heart shapes, and right, it has to do with feeling what is what you're feeling as opposed to remembering something. And there can be a great deal of joy in that. Just not knowing, just not knowing, not being so sure. So part of it has to do with being curious about what is true in the moment. I recently had reason to go through a box of old mementos, and I found some letters that I've saved for, I don't know, 30, 35 years, 40 years, I don't know, a long time. So you know these were really important letters. And I thought about them for a few days, and I decided I was going to read these old letters. So I started reading them, and as I got partway through them, I started having a really uncomfortable feeling. I got all the way through the letters. I immediately took the letters and shredded them, because I never wanted to read them again. Because these letters, which I had saved in anticipation of enjoying them in my later years, which these are, turned out not to be enjoyable to me at all, because my worldview has changed. Now, if you were to ask me when I started reading those letters, if I thought I would have that reaction, I would definitely have told you no. It isn't so much that I'm not conscious that I'm not the same person I was in my 20s. But I did not realize how much my view, my values, my consciousness had changed. I didn't really see it because it was pretty gradual over time, you know. And when I read those letters, I thought about the person who had received those letters, and I didn't know that person anymore. The reason this was so remarkable to me was that we carry with us this sense of a continual self. And if you had asked me, I would have told you I was pretty much the same person I was in my 20s. I don't think of, I'm always shocked when I look in the mirror that I don't see that person who in her 20s, right? But the fact is, there's been a huge shift over time, really a huge shift. And my impressions of those letters were so negative. I thought, ooh, I never want to read these again. The values that I had then didn't seem so bad to me then, but they seem bad to me now. And bad in the sense that they just don't fit. Not bad in that I was a bad person. Just that I couldn't identify with it anymore. And that was really interesting to me. I wasn't resonating with the same worldview. It just didn't fit. So there's a paradox that has to do with the minute and the gross. So when we talk about meditation and talk about insight, we're usually talking about noticing things on a very fine scale. You know, we talk about impermanence. This is one of the classic insights that arises out of meditation, is that we realize the impermanence of all things. And I think in my mind I had kind of equated that with change. Right? And we all know that change exists. But change is not the same thing as impermanence. And the thing that's different about it is that holding on to something. You know, even if something's impermanent, we kind of act like it's on a continual string and that we can follow it on that string. But impermanence means there's a discontinuance. You know, it just is different. Impermanence means that string isn't actually there. And we create this string that has to do with our memories and our stories. But impermanence is about that. It's actually discontinuous. It's kind of an interesting idea. So I don't know if that has meaning for you, but it has some meaning for me that has to do with this not being attached to what came before and not projecting into the future that if I do these things, then this will be the outcome. Like I control it, even though my experience leads me to believe that I do not control my life. I do not determine what comes next. And that's the point at which the finite pieces, the very fine structure of impermanence that we realize when we sit in meditation and watch how quickly everything morphs away from where we last looked at it. That actually manifests in a gross way in our lives as well. And that's what gives me encouragement for developing wisdom in my life. That I don't have to hold on to anything. That I don't have to be controlled by anything. That I can just experience life as it shows up. Just this. It doesn't have to be anything else. Now, this doesn't mean that we don't have intentions. You know, that we don't say, so for example, I said, I'd like to perhaps see myself as an equanimous, generous, compassionate person, which I'm not always. That doesn't mean I don't have to have that it is of no value to have an intention there, because like that mirror that is reflecting an image, if you don't look at it, you won't see it. And what you see when you look in that mirror is what you're looking for. We've all had this experience. So there are kind of two aspects. I don't know how many people are old enough to remember this, but do you remember Burma Shave signs? Does it have any meaning for you, Burma Shave? One person. Okay, I'm feeling... Okay, so the last Burma Shave signs disappeared in 1963, so it's not surprising that you haven't seen them, but they used to be a series of signs. It was a serial ad that went along the roads, and they were advertising a product called Burma Shave, and they had these cute little jingles, and each line of the jingle, it was like a roadside limerick, and each line of the jingle would be on a separate sign. And if you were going too fast, you wouldn't be able to read them. And so my father used to drive fast so that we couldn't read them. That was part of the tricks we were playing on one another. But it's also true that if you want to see those signs, you have to really pay attention. You have to catch the first one and the second one and the third one and the fourth one. There are usually five or six signs by the time you get the whole thing. You have to pay attention to see it. An intention is like that. If you have an intention, then you're looking for something to be true. And it creates a habit. So if we have habits of mind, there's nothing that says these habits are bad habits. They're just habits. So the ability to see those habits allows us to choose whether those habits are there or not. How we want to manifest those habits. Do we want to repeat those habits? So if I want to be generous, I practice being generous. If I want to slow down, I slow down. This is the value of intention, is that it conditions the next moment. It allows us to see where we want to go because that's what we're looking for. You really only see what you're looking for. We've all had the experience of going down the street and somebody says, "Did you see that fox?" And they'll say, "Fox? What fox?" right? Because you weren't looking for the fox. Of course, it might not have been there. Okay, so one thing to do is to look very carefully at, when you have an intention, what are you leaving out? What are you not allowing for the possibility of? And how can you be not so sure of what you're seeing? Not sure, not sure. As soon as I'm absolutely sure of something, that's when I say to myself, not sure. Because it probably means that I've built one of those constructs, one of those boxes that I put something in and labeled it. Tricky. So it's a warning to me, as soon as I'm sure about something, to look to see if I've constructed it, as opposed to just noticing what's there. So one more thought. Does it matter if you succeed in your intention? Does intention have a success tag on it? No, it really doesn't matter. Because what you're doing is you're setting something up and you're aiming for something. You know where you're going. So then it matters how fast you go. It matters what you bring with you. It's about the path. It's not about what's at the end of the path. It's really about the path. So I'm going to read that poem to you one more time, just to remind you that you have control of this. That it's really your choice what happens. That nobody can really tell you. That you don't have to be a monk. You don't have to be a nun. There's value in choosing that life, should someone choose that life. But it isn't that the freedom doesn't lie there. That's the form and not the practice. And that the path you choose is your path. No one tells you that path. No one leads you down that path. Someone can point you in the path, but the path is yours. The path is yours. So here it is, directions. Sometimes people ask me how to get to Jude Vine Mountain. I can tell you how to get to where the road ends, but when you get to there, you've only just begun. After that, I can't be any help at all. It takes years to find the way, and anyhow, you don't need me. I'm lost most of the time myself. Besides, how would I know what direction you're headed in? I wish you all heroic lives. Thank you.